The Theosophical Society presents Miss Joy Mills in a talk entitled, What is Death?
It may perhaps seem strange to you that in the midst of life, in the midst of another springtime, in the turn of the seasons, we should gather here to speak about death and think about this subject, which has seemed to excite both the greatest fear, the greatest anxiety, as well as the greatest interest among peoples. We all seek to avoid it at the same time that we are drawn towards it with a curiosity that is very difficult to satisfy. We are ready, actually, to believe almost anything about it, and yet, of course, we tend to doubt every belief. Dr. Harmon Brough has even suggested that one of the great paradoxes about death is that we do not think seriously about it because we take it too seriously. Certainly, the mystery of death has always been one of the greatest challenges to the human mind. Perhaps most of us this afternoon, however, are like the six-year-old youngster who wrote in a letter to God, "What's it like to die? I just want to know. I don't want to do it." So I presume this is why many of you are here this afternoon. And this is true for most of us. We would just like to know about it, but all of us would prefer, of course, not doing it. At least right now and right here. So if I said to you this afternoon that I would like to invite you to experience death with me, you would probably leave at once in some kind of fright. If I said that I should like to produce in you this afternoon something of the experience of death, you would undoubtedly think me mad, or at least begin to wonder what diabolical scheme I might have in mind. Of course, if my title were, "What is Life?" you would say, "Well, this we know. We experience it every day. We experience it constantly. So I certainly do not need to be told what life is." But do we really know what life is? And can we know what life is unless we know what death is? For actually it is through death that we become conscious of life. One of the oldest Chinese documents includes among the good fortunes that are promised to man the finding of a death that will crown his life. Because it is suggested, life receives meaning only from what lies beyond it. The great French biologist, Le Comte de Noailles, once said that the greatest invention of nature is death. In other words, even from a biological point of view, death is not a negation of life, but one of the means to add a new dimension to life, and thus to raise it to a higher level. In an old book, the Book of the Craft of Dying, it is written, "Against his will he dieth that hath not learned to die. Learn to die, and thou shalt learn to live, for there shall none live that hath not learned to die." And so this afternoon, this is precisely what I propose, to invite you to move with me into the experience of death itself. In addressing a group of students who were justifying lawlessness by the statement, "Well, a man must live," the Archbishop of York replied, "Oh no, a man does not have to live, but he must die." Unbroken physical continuity is a characteristic property of the lowest organisms, the most primitive and undeveloped forms of life, because physical continuity fetters the organism to the rigid laws of matter and the dictates of once established patterns, whose inherent repetitiveness prevents any deviation from the norm, and thus becomes the stumbling block in the way of further evolution. The rigidity of stones, rocks, crystals, mountains. The struggle of life to break through these rigid patterns of organisms in which unbroken physical continuity is the characteristic. Death, on the other hand, is the characteristic feature of the highest forms of existence, which achieve the survival of acquired properties and experiences through a new form of propagation that relies no more on division, but on integration. No more on a merely physical, but now on a psychic continuity, capable of building a new organism according to its own individual impetus. So perhaps what we do not realize, and what I would like to invoke in you, is the realization that we are experiencing death constantly, and that actually we cannot experience life without death. For are life and death really opposites? Is death the opposite of life? Or is it, as I would like to suggest, so intimate a part of life that life contains death as it contains birth? Death is not the opposite of life. Death is the opposite of birth. And both are contained in life. So as long just as one experiences birth but does not remember it, so one experiences death but may not remember it. You do not remember your physical birth, but you are very certain that it occurred, are you not? Do you have any doubts in your mind that you were born? But you do not remember it precisely and all of the events of it. And so we experience death, but do not remember it. It absorbs our attention, yes. Death becomes a concern, an anxiety, one of the three great anxieties, as Paul Tillich maintains, at the same time that we would really rather not think too much about it. If someone starts to talk about death, we say, well, let's change the subject. Let's talk about something pleasant as though death were unpleasant. Let's talk about something happy as though death were unhappy. But, of course, man has long realized the importance of death as the key to one of the great mysteries of life. Out of this realization, of course, grew the cult of the dead, one of the earliest forms of religion. It stimulated man to build the first enduring monuments of architecture, in contrast to the frail and transitory dwellings for the living. Man built enduring monuments to the dead, monuments that were not the outcome of necessity and want, of momentary needs or temporal unity, but of a will towards eternity, a spiritual urge that pointed towards a reality beyond temporal existence. The pyramids and mausoleums of antiquity are among the world's most enduring structures, all celebrating man's temporality, his transiency. Perhaps the most beautiful structure in the entire world, the Taj Mahal at Agra in India, a structure of such sheer and exquisite beauty that it appears to float as a marble dream upon the landscape, was built as a monument to the dead, as though to make marble sing in an undying paean of devotion, one could defy the passage of time and death itself. Death has, of course, inspired some of the greatest music and greatest poetry. Some men's deaths have been greater than their lives. And it has even been suggested that the power of the Christian religion lies less in the life of Jesus than in the manner of his death, which climaxed that life. So is it possible to look at death as an experience without fear? For, of course, if one is afraid, one cannot look with dispassion, with understanding. Can we look at this phenomenon, for that is what it is, not a state, but simply an event, a phenomenon that has its own naturalness, its own inevitability, as birth has its naturalness and inevitability? Can we look at death and see if we can understand what it is, and even, as I suggest, experience it in some meaningful way? So I am concerned this afternoon not with after death, not with some life in a hereafter that one may postulate, but life here and now and the experience of death. As Alan Watts has pointed out, the problem of death is not to be solved by the abolition of death, which would be analogous to chopping off one's head to cure a headache. The problem lies really in our own revulsion, and especially in our unwillingness to face this feeling of revulsion towards even the word, the concept death. And yet one of the greatest men of our time, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., said, not long before the tragedy of his assassination, "A man is not really free until he has conquered the fear of death." What we need really is a mind that can conquer death, for only such a mind is free, and only such a mind can look upon death and recognize it for what it is. I suggest we must develop in ourselves an habitual readiness to meet without fear whatever comes upon us, and to encounter directly whatever the future may bring. The great psychologist Dr. Carl Jung put it this way: only he remains alive who is willing to die with life. Well, perhaps we can look at death then, observe it with understanding, with dispassion, without fear, if I suggest to you that even since I began this talk, we have each one of us here died 1,000 deaths. In fact, by this time, if you are bored to death, you have died 1,001 deaths. Actually, we know death constantly in ourselves, and our task is to learn to die in the rhythm of life. Now, are you afraid of what you have been experiencing since you have been sitting here? Of what you are experiencing constantly? From the moment of birth, you begin to die, and so we can view ourselves as survivors of death already. The physical body, in all of its transformations and growth, is continually experiencing death. Cells die constantly, and new cells are being born. We are told, in fact, that in just one portion of the physical body, every day, an average of 30,000 nerve cells in the cortex of the brain die. Don't worry if you've forgotten things, you see. Maybe this explains loss of memory. Every day, 30,000 nerve cells in the cortex of the brain. We are each of us survivors of the death of millions of cells in our present bodies, as these cells have been sloughed off and replaced in the senescence and creative destruction which began as soon as we were born. Yet the germ cells from which we have unfolded are cells in a stream of protoplasm that has never died down through the ages. The continuity is in the flow, which is the background of the physical life. And death is simply the price which the living substance pays for all the expenditures through which and in which it lives. So when I say that you have in this past little while during which we have been together experienced 1,000 deaths, I may be underestimating the number. For death is so intimate a part of the rhythm of life that it is only really when we turn the full focus of attention upon it that we become fearful or experience it as a sense of loss. Every period of sleep is a half-death. Every transition from one phase of life to another is a kind of death. Life is an ocean with rising and falling tides, and death is always implicit in it. Turning to the level of human consciousness, we see we are survivors here as well, survivors of each night's extinction in sleep, survivors of the myriad events of childhood now dead to memory. Even here in this room, you are the survivors not only of constant physical change, but survivors of mental and emotional upheavals. Are your thoughts, your feelings, your sensations precisely the same now as they were when you entered this room? Can you even remember them all, let alone remember the experience of their passing? You may say, of course, well, you are only quibbling. You're not really discussing death, because death is something quite other than this transitory experience, which does not affect in any way the essential I-ness of each one of us. True, the cellular life of my body is undergoing a kind of death and transformation. My sensations, emotions, and thoughts are constantly shifting, but I am not very different from what I was. I continue to stand here, and you continue to sit there, and we continue to view each other without a loss of identity. We do not suddenly forget who each other is. Your thoughts have changed, perhaps, a multitude of times, and yet perhaps behind it you remember who you are. You are not confused. You will know how to get home. You remember who I am, and so on. So to know what death is, we say, we must know, and we demand to know, whether there is something unalterable, final, ultimate, that happens to this I-ness of me. And we say I must not just believe in something, but know in an inward way of knowing beyond all fear or anxiety that there is a fundamental continuity, not only of life, but of consciousness. But I would like to suggest that there is something in all this that we have been experiencing, this business of what is happening in our physical, emotional, and mental spheres, that may be important in our total consideration of the subject. For if we can remove fear even of the transiency of the physical body, then perhaps we can look at the vaster subject without fear, without anxiety. For actually, in a deeper and subtler sense, we have not been experiencing death at all. We have only been present at it. And because I have been present at it, just here, while all of this was going on, I am not afraid of any of it. And in addition to recognizing this subtle factor, that I am simply present at the death of all of this cellular life, the change of emotions and thoughts and so on, we may recognize also that death does not occur in isolation just as an event, but always in relation to something. As I suggested a moment ago, the death of the cells of the physical body is in relation to a total stream which never dies down. And even the death of the cells within this particular organism we call a physical body is in relation to the total body, its continuingness, as it were. So in a larger field, it is always, of course, I who die or you who die or a flower or a tree or an animal who dies. Death occurs against a background that is continuing. This particular flower dies, but there will be other flowers. Flowerness does not die, only the single, unique flower. And what we want to know, therefore, is whether this background of continuingness has something of the individual and unique in it, so that even though I, Joy Mills, may die, will die, in fact must die, will something that participates in the uniqueness now expressing itself as Joy Mills or through Joy Mills, something of an essential I-ness, continue, endure, even be possible of manifesting again somewhere. Now this sense of continuingness is a matter of consciousness. It's a matter of how one is aware. I am conscious right now that I am I, given a certain name, a certain structure, a certain order, which I give to the world through that existence of I-ness. Continuity arises, in other words, in a continuity, in an awareness of continuity, that I am I, and that I am I will continue to be I. If the perceiver, who is also our ego, the eccentric I, that I outside whatever is here, remains outside the temporal process, he does not at our death vanish from our view. In fact, we no longer have any. It is we who vanish from his view. So the certainty of death is related to the differentiation of human consciousness. And the problem of death is ultimately a problem of time and of our consciousness of time. How we experience death is determined finally by how we experience time. Concentration on the past and the future means that death is painful because it is a violent wrenching out of context. But if our focus is on the present flow of time, the normal and natural passage of events against the background of an essential wholeness, a background that is a unity and is therefore unified, death is experienced as natural also, and viewed as part of the total process of life. Actually, only to the living being are the modes of time essential. A cyclically ordered world knows death only as an organic phenomenon. We do not mourn the passing of the leaves in autumn and feel that they will be no more, for we recognize a cyclic order in the universe. It is only with the transformation of that kind of consciousness of time which perceives things in cycles, what has been called the mythical consciousness, aware of the great myth of return. Only with the passing of that kind of consciousness of time from its cyclical to its rectilinear form that a vision opens on the nevermore and a separation arises between past, present, and future. At a time when human beings had not lost their connection with their origins and their surroundings, in a world in which man was still in an intimate touch with nature, in a world in which there was nothing that could be conceived as lifeless, death, then, was not a contradiction to life, but a phase in the movement of life's pendulum, a turning point like birth. This was the view of Taoism, for example, and indeed the view of most of the great religions, in which the total rhythm of life is viewed as a coming forth and a returning. Coming forth is being born, returning is death. And so death is regarded as an easy parting. But the discovery for Western man particularly with the differentiation of consciousness, which was typical out of the roots of Greek and Western thought, and the dissociation of man from nature, which is typical of an industrialized technology in which we are no longer closely associated with nature but perceive ourselves as alien from nature. In fact, seldom see nature because we are engrossed in the concrete and asphalt of our cities. The discovery of linear time comes about and makes possible a directed consciousness of limits and plunges everything into the light of the unique and unrepeatable. And the more deeply this temporal consciousness takes hold of a living community, the more it will be drawn into the individualization of its members and feel death as a threat. For man's own lifetime, as it passes from year to year, the notion of repetition recedes in favor of the additive series. We notice this in the growth of a child to maturity, to adulthood. The child is often concerned with the repetitiveness of life. With autumn, he must return to school. With spring, now approaching towards the end of May, his attention is on release from school and another cycle of play and activity and enjoyment of the summer. But as we move on, and for most of us, as we move, most of us here, moving on towards middle and what we call the later years, the senior years, whatever the fancy name is now we give to an aging process, this notion of repetition recedes in favor of the additive series, and we feel, perhaps I will not see another spring. Perhaps it will not repeat itself. It is merely being added on in a cumulative manner, and the sequence of years begins to extend in a straight line and gradually takes on quite a different character from that of the great cosmic cycle. The human individual begins to line up his life inexorably as on a suspended string. And only the gods, it would seem, the gods of myth, retain the unquestioned prerogative of moving themselves and the world in pace with the circling vernal point and of achieving rejuvenation in the cycle. Now, in this focus of directed consciousness that is aware of its limits, we become aware of our relatedness to the future. And we see the future not as something in which we are fundamentally grounded, but as that towards which we must thrust ourselves in a forward movement. And so we make a virtue of living into the future. But in living through a becoming something, a development in this relation to the future, the individual moves towards his own death. If one were to take the time to analyze this matter of time and the consciousness of time fully, one could soon see that there are many varieties of time: primordial and mythical time, physical, biological, psychological, and historical time, and also cosmic time. What are the 7 days of creation at the outset of the Judaic Christian scripture? What are the great days of Brahm of the Hindu scriptures? One can study this matter, but there is not time to explore it this afternoon except superficially. For it is the time in which one is stuck, as it were, that determines the focus of consciousness. If I am stuck, and I use that word because it's a kind of sticky business, you know, we get stuck in the past. We hang on to an event of something that we enjoyed, and we hang on to it. If I am stuck in a certain time, this determines the focus of my consciousness, my awareness. For example, the rate of the disintegration of radium is extremely useful for physical dating, but it is meaningless for the qualitative determination of psychic or spiritual time, isn't it? If we were to go around and date each other, you see, by the rate of disintegration of radium when it was brought in contact with us, this would be a little foolish, would it not? And so we look at each other in another sense, in another dimension, and we view our own processes and of the processes of time from a subjective point of view. Have you ever heard someone say, but I don't feel like 70. I don't feel like 50. But nobody has ever defined what 70 ought to feel like. You know? You just assume that it ought to feel like something and you don't feel like that, you see. So it is the time in which we are stuck that determines the focus of our consciousness. And we discover finally, if we analyze time, that nothing remains of time but its temporality. So if I identify myself, if I am stuck in this transitory body at X number of years, you didn't think I was going to tell you, did you? If I am stuck in this physical body at X number of years, I suffer from the transitoriness of this physical body. For then I shall make the mistake of supposing that I shall pass away, whereas only the constituent parts that surround me will separate again. He who is beyond all becoming lives eternally. For never can death threaten the existence that accepts the finiteness of its envelopes, that accepts the passage of time because one refuses to be stuck in time. Existence must insist on its infiniteness if it wishes to arrive at a fear of death. The great Indian poet Tagore has put it this way: life, which is an incessant explosion of freedom, finds its meter in a continual falling back in death. This is true because, rightly understood, the release of life from form is a process of regeneration and transmutation that is infinitely repeated and can be experienced in every death of form when life transcends its outworn envelope. What matters then is not our extension in time, but our existence in depth. It has been suggested even that the biblical promise of eternal life is really a life in right relationship to eternity, a life in right relationship to the fundamental ground of our being, the unitary source of all life. Right relationship to that continuum out of which we arose and in which we are forever rooted. It is not infinity. It is a matter of dimension and not of duration. For if a man consciously gives himself over to the stream of time and does not remain on the bank, reflecting upon the past and the future, permitting fear and hope to unsettle the soul, and if the soul concentrates its whole life in the present, in the here and now, allowing that which is passing to pass away and that which is coming to come, then the heart resembles a mirror, free of dust, in which things reflect themselves as they come and go, always calling forth the right reactions. The point which turns into a problem is that I want immortality. The body is mortal and does not experience its mortality as disagreeable. It just dies when the time comes. But the body has, so to speak, an inner aspect, a consciousness, as we've pointed out, that imagines death before it comes, before it happens. And this is the idea of death which has preoccupied man since the beginning of time. It has, as I suggested earlier, influenced religions, cultures, and even political organizations. But consciousness is a living stream which cannot be caught in the vessel of a narrow ego because its nature is that of movement, of flowing. And flow means continuity, as well as the relationship between two levels or two poles. Without this polarity, there can be no movement, no life, no awareness. And without continuity, no meaningful relationship. The highest consciousness, the widest consciousness, is the product of the widest range of experience in the flow between two poles of universality and individuality. A movement, an experience of movement between the awareness of a universal self, which is the foundation, ground, background of my whole being, and the pole of being unique, individual. In such a view, death becomes, as Alan Watts has suggested, simply a return to that unknown inwardness out of which we were born, coming finally to a recognition that the truly inward source of one's life was never born. The average consciousness, of course, for most of us, is confined to the narrow circle of temporal aims and desires. What I want to do tomorrow, next week, next year, what I want to do 10 years from now, or 25, or whatever it may be. And sometimes when one says 25 years, there comes a shudder. Oh, I won't be here then. How do you know? This is where the narrow focus of consciousness generally moves, so that the great flow is hampered and diverted, its energy scattered, and the resulting light of awareness dimmed. When individuality, so focused, stuck at the present time, loses its conscious relationship with universality and tries to become an end in itself by clinging to its momentary existence, the illusion of a changeless separate ego is created, the flow arrested, and stagnation sets in. The cure for this, I suggest, is the realization that change, which is a natural and necessary condition of life, is not arbitrary or meaningless, but proceeds according to an inherent and universal law, which ensures the continuity and inner stability of movement. So, as one of the ancient scriptures of the East puts it, he who finds his way to the core of the self, whence rises all levels of the I, all spheres of the world, he who finds his way home to his first source with the question, whence am I, is born and reborn. Know that whoever is so born is the wisest of the wise. Each moment of his life, he is reborn anew. For the truly creative person, the interesting person to be with, the individual who is exciting, is the one who is always unstuck in the present, who moves always in relation to the continuity of life itself. The Chinese philosophy suggests that it is possible to form here and now a new body inside the earthly one. So even while you have been dying a million deaths here, your body undergoing constant change, your thoughts, your emotions, your sensations shifting, moving, the past dying constantly, you can form a new body here and now. In all the great religions, attention is given to this need in the sense that it is suggested that man must make some acquaintance with the after-death conditions during his lifetime in order that he may prepare himself properly for the creative life, for living wholly. As someone has put it, to be able to die not sloppily, but appropriately. I think most of us go on dying sort of sloppy deaths, with all sorts of things of the past hanging over. And we suffer from these hangovers of the burden of memories, the hangovers of emotional states, of mental frustrations instead of dying appropriately. In other words, we need to engender in ourselves a condition which, freed from the finite, represents the infinite in such a way as centers the I, that which says I, in an infinite eternal condition. Death then becomes bound up with something, with the becoming of something new, and it is a point similar then to birth. From time immemorial, the image of the hourglass has served to symbolize the relation between formalized time and death. This instrument also discloses the dialectic of the end, for it can be reversed, so that the sand begins to flow again toward a new beginning and a new end. If this reversal is recognized, the image recalls the cosmic concept of time, whose fundamental form is the circle, symbol of recurrence, rebirth, and eternal life. And so death becomes a birth, which is a great revolution in which a spiritual recentering takes place. Death is a birth that can occur now, and you are invited to experience it in this moment, in a spiritual recentering in which heaven and earth reverse themselves. For a man who has reached this point will not fear death anymore. He will consider it like sleep, a physiological occurrence which befalls all men in common, and that can be the more easily borne the less importance one gives to it as a process. And now in life too, he becomes, as it were, one reborn, and so he has an essentially different attitude towards life. He can say, indeed, with the neophyte who is instructed in the mysteries of death in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, "I am the Lord of the stairs. I have made my nest on the borders of the sky." For we become Lord of the stairs of our own growth, our own movement through time, towards that which we eternally are, but our abiding nest is on the borders of the sky. He will experience as a living reality the instructions given the neophyte in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. O nobly born, when thy body and mind were separating, thou must have experienced a glimpse of pure truth, subtle, sparkling, bright, dazzling, glorious, and radiantly awesome, in appearance like a mirage moving across a landscape in springtime in one continuous stream of vibrations. Be not daunted thereby, nor terrified, nor awed. This is the radiance of thine own true nature. Recognize it. From the midst of that radiance, the natural sound of reality reverberating like a thousand thunders simultaneously sounding will come. That is the natural sound of thine own real self. Be not daunted thereby, nor terrified, nor awed. For out of this experience of perceiving the immortal self, grounded in the continuum of universality, hearing the natural sound of the self, the reborn man comes down from the heights to the place where he is and fulfills the duties associated with this place in a practicable way, not from special virtue, but simply because this is the manner of participating in life that befits him now. He no longer needs to go to the beyond, for in the here, he is already in the beyond. This beyond is not separated from the here by either time or space. It is the meaning which penetrates alike all being and becoming. It is this that no longer allows death to seem a fearful thing, that makes life into one glorious eternity. For he whose life reveals the seal of such a moment has conquered not only time, but also death. And so, friends, death finally is really that which makes possible a new birth. It is the only means whereby growth is achieved and creativity is possible. The new may be built upon the old. Indeed, every incarnation is based upon and must grow out of the elements present in past incarnations. But always there is the possibility of something new, an essentially radical, different element being present. But for this possibility to exist, death must intervene to provide the ground of that possibility. And so perhaps at the end, all that can be said is that if every day to live is to die a little, I suggest that in leaving here, you die a little to what has been, even to what has been said. Die to this experience, that you may live creatively in a new experience, discover a new birth, and thus a transformed life. And then you will know, and I will know, what is death.